So this is a re-recording. Evidently, the first recording that I made and sent out came out very staticky. I answered a phone call in the middle. I put it on pause, and evidently it short-circuited my recording and audio. So let's start again. Throughout this series, I've tried to recast Gullus from a break in the action, a hiatus from history, a punishment, to a continuation of our national mission under different conditions that will naturally incite and evoke hostility and confrontation. And I've tried to help reclaim Gullus as part of our collective identity. I think this is important, especially in Israel, where there's a tendency to just amputate ourselves from Gullus and believe that Jewish history ended in 70 AD and then resumed in 1948. So I want to talk a little bit today about the three or the four oaths of Jewish history. Now, where do they come from? How were they used? And those who do believe that this is a divine event or a redemptive moment, how do you deal with this? So let's start at the beginning. I'll start with the Gemara in Ksuvos, and then we'll make our way back to Shir HaShirim and its source. Gemara in Ksuvos talks about Rabbi Zeira, a Talmud of Rabbi Yehuda. These are Amorayim, not Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the Tana, but the Amorayim, and Rabbi Zeira, his Talmud, wanted to move to Israel. As they open the Gemara, it's on Daf Kuf Yud Amid Beis. Rabbi Yehuda opposed this move. He quoted a pasuk in Yirmiyah. And then Rabbi Zeira either answered the pasuk or the Gemara suggested a potential defense for Rabbi Zeira. And then the Gemara says there's another pasuk that either Rabbi Yehuda quoted or was at the heart of his opposition. And that's the pasuk which appears more or less four times in Shir HaShirim. Hishbati eschem benos Yerushalayim im ta'iru ve'im ta'oreru es ha'ahava ad she'techbatz. Now, it appears four times. You can really talk about three times because the fourth time that it appears, not exactly the same language. So some want to imagine it as four as three oaths. Now keep in mind that each time that it appears, the shvuah may be a double shvuah, im ta'iru, the im ta'aru, esahava, ad she'techbatz. So there may be four, but without getting into the math of how many shvuahs there are, Rabbi Yehuda quoted this pasuk to ban and to prohibit his Talmud from making aliyah. Hashem says, don't go up, don't make aliyah until the time comes. Now, interestingly enough, even Rabbi Zeira, who did make aliyah, who did elude his Rebbe's opposition, even he agrees, the Gemara says, that these oaths do create some hesitation and barrier. We'll talk about that. But it didn't apply to him, he felt, because it was just one lone individual. The oaths do not prevent a lone individual from making aliyah or from moving to Israel. They prevent, as the Gemara says, the Jews should not be ya'alu b'choma, they shouldn't go up as one brick wall, namely altogether mass emigration. One is shelo yimredu b'umas ha'olam, they shouldn't rebel against international interests and authority. And then one of them, again, according to this version, there were only three oaths, because the fourth time it's mentioned in Shir HaShirim, it's a little different language, so the three oaths. And the third oath is directed against the Gentile world. They shouldn't excessively persecute the Jewish people. So the takeaway from Ksuvos is that Rabbi Yehuda did not want even an individual moving to Israel because of these oaths. And Rabbi Zeira said, you know what, these oaths are more collective and historical, they're not personal. But it sounds like the common denominator is you can't mass migrate to Israel, emigrate to Israel against international opposition because of the oaths of Shir HaShirim. This literal reading formed the core of the Sefer Vayoel Moshe, written in 1952 by the Satmar Rebbe, Rebbe Yoel Teitelbaum. And in this Sefer, he says that these oaths prohibit Jewish initiative to return to Israel before HaKadosh Baruch Hu summons us. And because our return to Israel violated these three historical oaths, the Jewish people were punished with the Holocaust, and he traces some of the grisly and grotesque scenes of the Holocaust back to the Gemara's sentencing for those who violate the oaths. I'm not going to drill down to the Satmar Rebbe and what Satmar Hasidus is or isn't, but very often people who don't agree with him ideologically fail to appreciate that he and his Hasidim stand for Avas Yisrael. Anyone who's ever spent a day in a hospital in New York City and has received the unlimited chesed of Satmar in the hospital rooms, in the apartments given to you to spend time near your relatives, in the food, realizes that this is a culture based in Avas Yisrael. And the Satmar Rebbe loved our people so deeply, and he felt that our national destiny was being so threatened that he rallied with all of his indignation to protect you and me the way he saw it. So don't let ideology or ideological differences distort your judgment. That's a big problem in today's world. Judge issues intellectually honest and then choose your ideology. It's like shooting an arrow and then drawing the target when you allow your intellect to be drawn by your ideology. So now, those who disagree with the Satmar Rebbe about this issue, and I count myself amongst them, well, how do you deal? How do we deal with the oaths that even Rabbi Zera, the Aliyah person, felt banned, Ya'alu b'choma, not emigrating in mass, Yimradu b'umas olam? So there really are two answers, two sets of answers. And I just want to discuss the first set, which is not going to be the theme of today's podcast, and then I'll describe the second answer, or the thing I do want to try to elucidate. One set of answers is, yeah, they're oaths, and they do ban and prohibit us from arising as a wall and from rebelling, but they no longer apply. Why do they no longer apply? So the most popular response is because no one rebelled against anyone. Our return to Israel, our return as a people, was a slow, gradual process, aided and enabled by international diplomacy, approved through various international approvals, the Peel Commission, the Balfour Declaration, the UN vote, the recognition of the State of Israel. So if all of a sudden we would have woken up one day and mass emigrated to Israel against the entire world's opinion, that would have been one thing. Now, we still face a lot of opposition, but that's despite all the international attempts to approve the state of the Jewish people. Another approach, a little less popular, the same concept, is that there's a symmetry to the shvuos. Two parts of that three-part shvua, let's work with the classic three-part shvua, are directed against or towards the Jewish people. Don't rebel, don't en masse emigrate. But one is directed to the Gentiles. Don't persecute the Jewish people excessively. Well, after 1940 and 1942 and 1940, after the Holocaust, the rules of the game have obviously changed. The Ummah Salam have persecuted us throughout history. I'll talk about this later, but nothing was like the Holocaust. And once the Holocaust is a deal breaker. Holocaust is a game changer. Once they persecuted us excessively, we have a responsibility to defend ourselves, and we are released of any statutory, contractual, oath-ridden responsibility. The third answer to the Satmar Rebbe's claim is if you, and even the Satmar Rebbe would agree, that the oaths are not eternal, it's ad shetechpas. Don't accelerate the love until the time has come, until Hashem wants it, until history wants it, until both sides want it. Well, if you look around you, could this be the time ad shetechpas? There are four or five signs that this is real. The flourishing of Torah, the ingathering of exiles, the fertility of our land, the exponential growth of our state. Maybe this is ad shetechpas. So it's one thing to try to rally Jewish emigration in the middle of Poland of the 14th century or the middle of, I don't know, Iraq of the 8th century. But history seems to be turning. Those are one set of answers, that there's an oath here and the oath is binding, but there's an expiry date, or we're complying with the oath by following our return to Israel based on international approval. Then there's a completely different approach. And it's an approach taken by the Maharal, more or less, by the Avnei Nezer of Avram Bornstein, more or less, 19th century, Sachashava Hasidus. What does it mean to take a legally binding oath? Who took the oath? Hashem took the oath. I took the oath. My great-great-grandfather took the oath. We have no record of anyone taking an oath. Oaths happen between people, not between human beings and HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the halachic system. Even if in theory someone took the oath, maybe Shlomo HaMelech, oaths don't pass from one generation to the next. They're not inherited. To really treat these oaths as halachically binding, Rabbi Yehuda was opposed to his Talmud making Aliyah, and he felt that his read of Shir HaShirah meant that it applied even to an individual, and Rabbi Zera felt no. But these aren't oaths. And no one's breaking oaths, and no one's violating halacha. So if they're not oaths, what are they? So here's the metaphor. The metaphor I want to develop, and I developed it in the first year, but I guess this is the second round. The second round's always better than the first round. Normally get a chance to rethink. Here's the metaphor. The oaths in Shir HaShirim are the thermostat of Jewish history. Now, to help develop that metaphor, let's talk a little bit about Shir HaShirim. Okay? Shir HaShirim is a story, at a literal level, about a man and a woman courting each other. And they meet with all the normal obstacles and delays of courtship. Now, of course, it's a metaphor for our relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu and our attempts to get on the same page romantically with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Now, there are two ways to read Shir HaShirim. One way I call Shir HaShirim in a vacuum, in a bottle. And one way I call Shir HaShirim, and it's organic Shir HaShirim, holistic Shir HaShirim. Namely, one approach is to say that you don't read the story, you don't pay too much attention to what's happening between this man and this woman. They're all just coded references, words, letters that Chazal darshan and applied to Jewish history, and you know, you don't read too much into the actual story to help you understand the drash. That's obviously not the way I read Shir HaShirim. I've done a lot of work on Shir HaShirim, and Mirtz Hashem, Mezus Hashem, I hope to one day put out a sefer in Shir HaShirim, that there is a pollination between the pshat and the drash, and you're able to understand the drash in part by understanding what's happening in the story and seeing the drashos in context of the story. Now, first of all, what's the story of Shir HaShirim? It's a hard sefer. A lot of people don't know where to start, where to end. It's one long lyric. But the best mapping I can give you is ignore the prakim. There are 8 prakim. There are Christian prakim. It's a pretty decent job, if you ask me, but it is no way an accurate structuring of Shir HaShirim. The accurate structuring of Shir HaShirim is a 5-part book. Each part ends with a chorus. Part 1 ends with the chorus number, the first time the chorus appears. Part 2 ends the second time the chorus appears. Part 3 ends the third time the chorus appears. Part 4 ends the fourth time, and then there's a conclusion after the fourth chorus. What is the chorus? Well, you'd be surprised. The chorus, the pasuk that repeats itself 4 times in Shir HaShirim, is this pasuk. Hishbati etchem benos Yishalayim, I'm making you swear. Im ta'iru, don't awaken our love. Im ta'aru, don't protest it. Le'orea means to protest, so don't awaken it, don't protest it. Esahava achetechbats. It appears at different stages of the story, and that's how you read Shir HaShirim. And what's its function? Its function is, as this relationship between the man and the woman veers in either extreme direction, too hot or too cold, too forward or too delayed, too accelerated or too gradual, this chorus comes in and says, there is a pace, have confidence, don't move too quickly, don't move too slowly. So for example, just to give a little bit of example, in Perek Beis, which is the first time it appears, the woman has just met the man. All of a sudden, she's talking about being together in the cellar of wine and having his left hand under her head and his right hand hugging her. And they're not even married yet. Of course, everything's a metaphor. So at that point, this is in Perek Beis, don't awaken the love too much. Don't protest it. Let it happen naturally. There's a pace. Let it unfold naturally. Or the second shvu. I don't know if I have a Shir HaShirim in front of me, so I'm just quoting the psukim in general. She's looking through the streets, trying to find him. I'm going to find my lover. I almost missed him. Until I found him, I'll hold tight to him until I bring him to my mother's house. Again, very forward, very assertive. Now comes in the chorus. Slow down. It's a pace. It's going to happen. Then, of course, the third shvuah is a very different thermostat effect, because the third shvuah is after the big rupture, and she's lazy, she doesn't let the man into the house, and he knocks, and she doesn't answer, and he disappears, and she's frantic, and she's panicking, where is he, I don't know if I'll ever find him again. And then the calm, cool voice of the narrator, don't worry, it'll happen, no one's going to protest the love, you're not going to accelerate the love, this is the long ball, the long story, the long view, the long process. Namely, if you just read the story of Shir HaShirim, the function of Shvat Yeshem is any time the relationship gets too feverish, slow it down. If it gets too lackadaisical, give this confidence, this reassurance that it will last. That's what I call it, the thermostat of the story. Now, the metaphor, of course, that's the literal reading. The metaphor is that it's the thermostat of galus. As I've tried to demonstrate in these shiurim, this galus gula thing is a really, really tricky high wire act. On the one hand, we wait and we have promises and animamins, and according to the Rambam, it's heresy not to believe in Mashiach, and we're waiting and we know redemption is inevitable and there's a terminus and we're just waiting and predicting and we love Hashem and we want Hashem and it's coming, and all of a sudden it could get too imbalanced and too disorienting and it could distract us from the affairs of the day-to-day and the places we live and our Torah and mitzvos, and it can gobble up halachic fidelity because I'm in a redemptive era. So Hashem says, you know what, slow it down. And then there are times in galus where we just feel distant and dry and cold and underconfident and alone, and we didn't answer the door and we never think Hashem will come back, and then Hashem says, don't worry, it's still there. Ani ledodi v'dodi li. So this pasuk and these oaths are, don't go too quickly. But all the time, knowing that you're not going to go too quickly, don't try to constantly live with this restless messianic energy and fever that every single minute you're thinking about, how can we go up? It's not an oath about a particular type of decision. It means don't spend your life thinking about how you're going to return Bechoma and Yemrid. It will happen. Who knows when it will happen? It will happen. Im Ta'aru, but also Im Ta'iru. Don't accelerate it. Don't augment it and magnify it. It will happen. Namely, it's a thermostat to help us calibrate galus and geula properly. And it enters in the storyline when we're too excited about geula, and it enters into the story when we're lost in galus. And Hashem is giving us a shvua to steady galus, to create that very, very delicate equilibrium. That's one function of the thermostat between the different poles of galus and geula. The second function of this thermostat is this very strange and ambitious anthropological project that galus is launching. To take a people and send them across the world and have them hosted for 2,000 years by Gentile nations. Good luck with that. And Hashem is creating a set of guidelines for both parties to more or less coexist, more or less, to play in the same sandbox, when Hashem knows that one person playing in the sandbox is making great sandcastles, because Jews are smart, and Jews are great at business, and Jews are literate, and Jews are obstinate, and Jews are... And at some point, it's not going to be so easy to live side by side, because we're separate, but we're together, and we're smart. Hashem tells the Jewish people, look, you're going to be hosted by France, by England, by Russia, by Poland, by Iraq, by Syria, by Egypt. You got to just play by the rules. Don't spend your whole time rebelling. Don't spend your whole time fighting and insurrections and mutinies, and you're moving, and I know, but just take your fate, embrace your world, make the best of your situation. And Hashem turns to the goyim and says, by the way, you're going to host my people. I know there's going to be frictions and tensions, but just, you know, don't persecute them endlessly. So these are not halachically binding oaths. These are ground rules that Hashem sets up for history. And by and large, these ground rules have been successful. So these aren't oaths banning us from behavior. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Shlomo, through Ruach HaKodesh, telling us how this is all going to come down. How are we going to make it through this strange and delicate balance between galus and geula? With the dual voices, the confidence and the caution. We know that in Ta'aru, no one's going to protest and sabotage the love, but in Ta'aru, we know that it's not going to happen as soon as we want. And we also know that we're not going to spend all of our time battling our host nations, and they're not going to spend all their time persecuting us, but more or less, the long view of history hasn't worked the best, but it's worked more or less. Hashem created a framework. And that's why the Pasuk is such a good way, as we reach the end of this series, Pasuk is such a good way to help us, as a prison, to understand galus. This is the pasuk that helps us balance ourselves through the rough waters of galus, internally rough waters, and the rough waters of the host countries that surround us. So, again, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe, thought that it was an isser, and we violated the isser. There's a range of responses as to why the oath no longer applies. But many feel that this isn't an oath. Well, if it's not an oath, what is it? It's a thermostat. What I mean by thermostat is it creates a steadying, calming influence on this riotous experiment called Gullus. Internally, it helps us realize we can't accelerate, we can't delay. It'll be there. There's a pace. Just have confidence in the process. Vis-a-vis our relationship with the host nations, it's a set of ground rules that everyone should get along.